The captain had unfolded his portable chair on the quarterdeck and surveyed the coast and mountains through binoculars. Sherla and Shimchisko and Ebert watched with somber expressions. "What's wrong?" I asked. Shimchisko hitched up his shoulders and shook his head with a whistling release of breath. "Martha's Island doesn't know us," he said. "We'll be getting acquainted." Ebert nodded grim agreement. "Samplers aren't always the same," he said. "Not always small. Not always gentle."
"Nonsense," Sherla countered. "Every ECOS is polite."
That expression found favor among a certain large segment of the immigrants who idealized the landscape and ECOS. A kind of mythology had sprung up. The many mothers of life, it was said, were polite, always nurturing.
"That's not what my father says," Kisbeck observed.
He had descended from the main tree shrouds with Riddle. Both had pushed their way through the crew to the port rail and stood beside us.
"Jittermeier lost three of his crew here. Nobody ever found them. My father sailed with Jittermeier."
We wondered why he had not mentioned this before.
"He did. Two men and a woman vanished, and my father said they were sampled."
"Why didn't you tell us about your father before?" Ebert asked.
"He wasn't proud of me. I'm a clown."
Shimchisko snorted. Riddle and Ebert seemed more sympathetic.
"No, I know what I am, and so did he," Kisbeck said. "But that's how I got my berth on the Vigilant. Not every zone need be as sweet as Liz," he concluded portentously. "We should listen to experience."
Sherla shook her head, unconvinced. Rumors passed quickly. The crew's anxiety increased as we approached the eastern headland and sailed through more stretches of shallow, dead water. We could not make out any scions, even from a few hundred meters. The spits between the island's center and the headlands were sandy desert. As we prepared for our stay on the island, I helped Salop arrange his equipment in the longboat.
"I hear you do not have a strong family," Salop said, helping me carry two crates of specimen jars to the boat.
"No," I said. "I don't." He was a small man, with a face that seemed suited to sardonic opinions, dark eyes set unevenly above strong cheekbones smeared with black rouge, a finely trimmed graying black goatee, and square patches of hair trimmed free like islands at his temples. He wore loose-fitting black pants and a long black coat that seemed to fill out his thin body.
"The master tells me you learn quickly."
He gave me a look that seemed at once both unconcerned and challenging, as if daring me to disagree, or trying to provoke me.
"So I have agreed to take you on."
"I am honored," I said, climbing the ladder to the longboat in its chocks and carefully lowering the box of bottles. We loaded a wire-wrapped cube of stacked folding Lisbu mesh cages for capturing small scions alive.
"Still," he continued, "there could be resentment. If you boast, I will send you back to the apprentices. And your duties will remain those of a sailor when we are not ashore and I have no use for you. Does that seem fair?"
I nodded.
"Good. We will accompany the first party to go ashore."
He wiped his hands on a towel and looked across the blue sea to Martha's Island.
"Shulago and Baker said the central island and Mount Jittermeier were covered with thick silva. Something has changed. Perhaps we won't need so many cages."
The Vigilant weighed anchor in a small cove just below the tallest of the island's central peaks, Mount Jittermeier. The sun had dropped behind the western headland, and the mountains were black against the yellow twilight sky. Electric lanterns were switched on, and the deck became a patch of bright stars against the gray-blue ocean and the silhouette of the island beyond. The apprentices and ABs were relieved of their duties and sat on deck at leisure, enjoying the warm evening air, yet still keeping nervous eyes on the looming blackness of Mount Jittermeier, outlined by stars and faint ribbons of moonlit cloud. Dinner was served on deck as a kind of celebration, and the captain and officers and researchers joined the crew topside. The other researchers took my promotion from the ranks with fated nonchalance.
"It's only what I expect from Randall and Salop," Shatrow said to Thornwheel just within my hearing. 9 days out of 10, Sir Salop's a martinet, and by the rules this, by the rules that. On the 10th, he's as generous as a bottomless bucket."
After dinner, a keg of mat fiber beer was shared out on the main deck.
I sat on the port gunwale with Ebert, Meissner, Shimchisko, and Sherla. We dangled our feet over the side, backs to the light, facing the darkness, and listening to the waves as we sipped the weak, bitter brew with its faint ginger-garlic tang. From the night-bound shore came the soft grumble of breakers on the black lava sand beaches. We had not seen any signs at all so far, even on the mountain slopes, and that worried the captain. "It's wrong," he said from his chair as Randall brought him a mug. "Martha's Island had a rich and lively ecos when Baker and Shulago last explored. A full silva both sides of the island. We haven't seen anything. It looks as if the whole island is dead." That seemed to excite him. He turned to Salop, who stood with arms folded a few steps away. "It'll be primary science, pure and direct, eh, Mansur?"
"It will, sir," Salop replied, smiling calmly.
"By the good man, it will," the captain murmured, eyes glittering, and sipped from his mug. He licked his lips with broad satisfaction.
"Think of it, friends."
He swept the deck with his happy gaze, taking in those of us who sat on the gunwale, his researchers, the other apprentices where they lounged and ate or drank.
"How many scientists, how many humans over the years have had a chance to do primary science?"
"We will not just clean up little details," Salop said, echoing the captain's enthusiasm. He rubbed his chin.
"Here's to Sir Korzhenovsky, designer of the way," he said, lifting his mug. "To his audacity!"
The crew sat in silence. All conversations stopped in uncertain embarrassment. Salop's gaze met mine. He was as interested in my reaction as I was in his. Randall broke the silence, and to good length, who used the way as it was meant to be used, and broke the evil slide of fate in Numa.
"Hear, hear," the captain said, his face flushing deeper red. He lifted his mug. "To good length, who guides us all."
The crew joined the toast. The awkward moment did not pass completely, however. The mood of the evening, set by the warm breezes and the comfortable, bright glow of electric lights, the keg of mat-fiber beer, broke, and the crew wandered about the deck, finishing up small chores, preparing to sling hammocks above decks and sleep in the warm night air. When the others were settled, Sherla and I still stood by the gunwale, listening to the breakers. "We're awfully confused, you know," she murmured.
"I wish I knew what to think sometimes."
The longboat set out with first light commanded by Salop. The captain stayed aboard for this first sortie, in case the island might prove dangerous. He clearly did not enjoy this precaution, and gave Salop detailed instructions on what to look for, what to record on both of their slates, and when to return with a preliminary report. On the boat were two apprentices, Skop and Anne King, low-profile types who seldom volunteered but were picked by Randall for this reconnaissance, and Randall himself. Shatro, Thornwheel, and I filled out the complement. The boat crossed the few hundred meters to the shore, a narrow black sand beach scattered with lumps of pumice and broken bits of toughened scion fiber. We dragged the boat from the shallows up onto the beach, then walked up and down the strip of sand, the smooth glassy grains squeaking beneath our feet. Salop ordered us to gather several boxes of samples, the flotsam and jetsam of Ikoi from around the Darwin Sea.
"The ocean brings them to us for free," he said.
Beyond the beach, a storm-eroded cliff 10 meters high revealed layer upon layer of volcanic ashfall, alternating gray and black. Buried within the layers, Randall and Shatro found desiccated remnants of scions perhaps centuries old. We dug out these delicate specimens with small rock picks and shovels, shriveled brown husks, victims of ancient eruptions from the same volcanoes that pushed up from the sea and gave birth to the island thousands of years ago.
"This much we know about Lamarckia," Salop said, kicking at the black scoria capping the cliff. "It is younger than Earth by 1 billion years, more active volcanically, but 500 kilometers less in diameter. There has been much less continental weathering of deposited crust from the era of lime testates, shelly microfossils. Nearly all the metallic ores are volcanic in origin. Likely, if we really wish to find rich veins of metal ores, we will have to look 5,000 meters beneath the continents, or deep beneath the waves."
We left the boxes of desiccated scions on the beach, atop some low flat lava boulders to avoid the waves. Beyond the beach cliffs, gentle rolling hills, ancient fumaroles eroded by wind and rain, stretched half a kilometer to the razor-ridged steep slopes of Mount Jittermeier. Lava boulders, scoria, and crumbled eroded flows of twisted lava covered the hills. The ground was cool, however, and no vapors emerged from the cracks or from the inland mountains. Salap surveyed the mountains, sucking on his cheeks thoughtfully. With a small tongue cluck, as if in moral disapproval, he turned to Randall and Shatro. When Shulago and Baker were here, they could smell sulfur for dozens of miles out to sea. It's very quiet now, and no smell.
We'll spend a half hour looking over this sector, Randall said. Chief objects of our search will be Petrids.
He showed us a reproduction of a sketch by Baker of hand-sized flat scions clinging to lava, leaving trails of white behind. Serving the place of lichens, Petrids or rock grinders of various sizes and shapes were found in all known Ikoi. We'll also be looking for scion fumets. Droppings, generally flat smooth disks, were rarely visible in active Ikoi because of collection and cleanup. If this ecos was declining, we might find more droppings, or none at all. Watch your step. Shulago calls this very treacherous territory. Lots of old lava tubes and sinkholes.
We spread out over the hills in the hot sun. I clutched a fiber hat and a bag for small specimens. I fell twice before adapting to the terrain, skinning my knuckles and knees. The best place to look for fixed scions, I thought, would be inland a few hundred meters. I visualized them soaking up sun between the boulders.
Think energy. An ecos manages energy the way any organism does. Sunlight, air, water, minerals. Scions specifically adapted to taking advantage of certain niches for energy and raw materials. Treading black sand paths through a maze of fragmented lava, I peered into shadows beneath overhangs, scuffing at the sand with my boots, scraping several centimeters deep with a small shovel. Nothing. When the half hour had passed, we regrouped on the beach. Salap shaded his eyes against the sun and turned down his lips at our empty bags.
So the ecos is hiding, or...
He shrugged, refusing to speculate out loud.
We will find Shulago's trail not far from here if it's still marked. There is a small sheltered valley at the base of Mount Jittermeier. It is a hike, but I believe we can find it and be back before the captain gets upset.
He gave us all an enigmatic look, partly conspiratorial, partly rueful. I detected a hint of rivalry here. Salap wanted to explore the island on his own terms. As we walked down the beach and searched for the trailhead, Shatro picked up a piece of leathery scrap and passed it around for examination. Dark brown, dried to the consistency of xyla, it still held a few threads in punched holes.
Part of a shoe, Randall offered.
Not a scion, Shatro said.
Disappointing, Salap said, shaking his head sadly. What has happened here?
We did not find any trail markings, but a sandy path between the boulders showed promise. The path climbed the side of the mountain and veered around an andesitic outcrop.
This is Shulago's trail, but the arborids are gone, Salap said, pointing to empty circles of stones and conical depressions in the ground on either side. When the arborids were here, they pushed boulders away and took root. They have crawled away or died.
We followed the path for 100 meters around the outcrop, and then through a tumble of large boulders, some stacked in arches, over the trail. The sun warmed my arms and made my scalp sweat within the hat. I felt sad and sleepy. After 4 kilometers, a few purple and dark blue stalks showed over a close rise.
At last, Randall said, something alive.
Beyond the rise stood a copse of small, squat, palm-like arborids. Spiky leaves spread over round boles in a furry cap. Translucent brown roots formed nets over the ground between the arborids, and along the roots crawled shiny orange vermids, worm-like creatures, each about 4 centimeters long. We paused by the edge of this pitifully small and confined silva. Randall, Shatro, and Salap examined the scions quickly, making notes on Salap's slate. I recognized none of them from the illustrations and photos of either the Jittermeier or Baker Shulago expeditions.
Big differences, Salop said. Fluxing and reissue of new scions. The island is no longer hospitable.
Competition? Shatro asked brightly.
War? A sexing?
Salop looked to the skies and shook his head. There was only one Ecos on Martha's Island, and we're 1,000 miles from Elizabeth's land, 1,500 miles from Shea. Scions from Pelagic Ecoi stick close to the islands and continental shelves, except for unfortunates who stray. And both Shulago and Baker and Jittermeier said the Ecos on Martha's Island dominated its zone, even out to 100 miles from land. It was well fortified. How could there be a sexing, much less a takeover?
Shatro was still hopeful his idea might be proven possible, if not correct. We saw racers from Patain, or perhaps from Shea or Ephraia's land. Why are they out here, unless a zone senses opportunity?
What opportunity? Salop asked, his temper rising.
It is empty, Ser Shatro. A zone has subsided here. It is in decline.
Old age, I suggested, partly to break Salop's fix on the unfortunate Shatro. Salop rolled his eyes heavenward again, but said nothing, walking ahead between the arborids to the bottom of the small valley. The air was cooler and moister in the shade of the arborids. It smelled of nothing in particular. I touched the trunks and leaves as we passed, but no stomata opened. There seemed to be only these two kinds of scions, unknown arborids and vermids.
We haven't been sampled, Randall said as we approached the lowest part of the valley, 0.5 kilometer from the rise.
That I don't miss, Shatro said.
Still, it's significant, Randall said. The Ecos may no longer be curious. Unique in my experience.
We've only been here a few minutes, Shatro said, glancing around. Maybe they're waiting for the right moment.
The trail broadened into a sandy flat. At the center of the flat, a hip-high wall of lava boulders surrounded a clear, sparkling pool. A spring bubbled to one side, and the waters rippled over a bed of black sand, sparkling in the bright sun. From the walled spring to the copse, a path was marked by smaller lumps of reddish lava.
Not scions, Randall said. Someone's living here.
We took the marked path back into the copse. 50 paces from the spring, a dark gray, weather-beaten house rose on short stilts, surrounded by pink and gray arborids. The roof was made of some sort of gray leathery skin, as were the walls. The rest of the square, ungraceful structure was made of strips and beams of pinkish xyla. At the sound of our voices, a woman stepped out onto the narrow porch, dressed in sack-like brown robes, face pale, her long black hair prominently streaked with gray. I guessed her to be about 70 years old. She stood with hands on the rail, staring at us for a moment with pale blue eyes. Her skin was dark, her limbs skinny, and she worked her mouth as if searching for words under her tongue.
"I am Liazin Tre Nimjian," she said in a squeak.
She cleared her throat and repeated her name.
"I live here. What do you want?"
"Are you alone?" Randall asked.
"Not to alarm you, Ser Nimjian," Salop said, touching Randall on the shoulder. "I am honored to meet you. I did not know you were still here."
He turned and whispered in Randall's ear. The woman looked at us one by one, eyes wide.
"My husband died 5 years ago. I've been alone since. Human voices and faces quite stun me."
Salop introduced us formally, and then explained.
"Sers Liazin Tre Nimjian and Yeshova Nakrasik were feared dead. They were researchers with Baker and Shulago."
"We did not choose to stay," Nimjian said.
She held out her hands.
"Do you have a ship? Of course you must. I would dearly love to see a ship, to dine with the captain."
"It would be our privilege," Salop said, bowing his head.
That evening, most of the crew sat down to the best that Frey the cook could offer on board the Vigilant. I sat at the table next to the captains, with Randall, the first mate, and the junior researchers, including Shatro. Nimjian sat with the captain and Salop, and Talia Rydiem and Shirla, the female ABs at table to make her feel at home. Indeed, the women spent much time fussing over her as they might over a revered elder.
Liazin Nimjian seemed to fall into a trance even before the dinner began.
"So long," she cooed as she sat at the head table in the mess. "This seems wonderfully elegant to me. It's been years since I ate human food. Bread! And so much news! I do not believe all I have missed."
"Your story must be extraordinary," the captain said. She drew herself up proudly.
"I have lived on our island for 12 years now. The first years were good, but after my Yeshova died, mostly work."
She leaned toward the captain.
"You're following in the path of Baker and Shulago. You are going to circumnavigate."
"That we are," the captain said.
"That explains Sir Salap and his wonderful interest in Martha's Island. Who else would go this far out of the way to visit such a lonely place? Well, for you all, then, I have a story to tell. It is about secrets, and the death of the only living thing I have come to know and to love besides my husband. Tomorrow I will show you where it all happened, and tonight and tomorrow perhaps I can explain why."
After the meal we returned to the quarter-deck to sit under the double oxbow and listen to Ser Nimjin's story.
"When I joined the Baker and Shulago expedition, I was an agro, a farming specialist. I had learned how to care for terrestrial crops without disturbing the ecos and bringing on a defensive response. Something rarely seen now, I suspect, but common enough then. My sponsor was Yeshova, the man who would become my husband." "Yeshova."
She lingered on the name in silence for a moment, smiling softly.
"He thought I could teach Baker and Shulago a thing or two about specialization in ecos populations. We put to sea with 2 ships, the Hanno and the Himilco. They were smaller than this one, and less well prepared. Baker and Shulago may be heroes and martyrs to many now. I've only just learned they never returned, that only Chuki made it back in the smaller ship."
She paused and drew several deep breaths as if to calm herself. With one hand to her neck, absently stroking the brown and wrinkled skin there, she gathered her thoughts.
"Not so long ago, it seems. My life has taken on a certain sameness the past few years. You know of our journey from Athenai to the northern continent, where no ecos grows, and from there to Shia. We sailed along the western coast of Shia, then south to the Cook Straits, and found a passage, discovering 6 more zones on the Cook Islands, small, simple ecoi, really, compared to Elizabeth's Land and Shia. We captured specimens, dissected them, and wherever we went, the ecoi were curious. I was personally sampled 33 times.
She lifted her arms to show us tiny pockmarks, some as large as thumbprints. She also pointed out pox on her neck, and lifted her robe to show several on her ankles and legs.
We followed the eastern coast of Afraya's Land to the southernmost point, which we named Cape Manu, after our navigator. We rounded Cape Manu, and returned to the Darwin Sea, rather than face ice-bound winter seas to the east.
She looked up at her audience, face drawn with memories.
It was a difficult journey. We lost 7 to accidents, my brother among them. We could not fight the Westers south of the Shaft Island group. We could not cross in that direction. We were running out of food. We put into the Shaft Islands. Shulago did not want to return to Jakarta, though it was only 600 miles away at the time. There were small farm towns in the Shaft Islands. We visited them. We were lucky to get enough supplies to go on.
All the islanders died during the famine of 26, Salap said. Nimjian looked vague, as if this bit of history did not have any real meaning for her. Then she mustered what she thought would be a polite response.
I'm sorry. They were nice people, very eager to hear our stories. They thought Baker and Shulago were heroes. They thought we were all heroes. But we were just tired and hungry.
Nimjian seemed reluctant to continue.
You sailed north, so Chuki's journals say, the captain prodded.
Nimjian rubbed her hands together as if to warm them.
"'Baker and Shulago had an argument,' she said. "'They always seemed like angry monkeys in too small a cage, "'yet they always insisted on living aboard the same boat. "'They wanted to keep watch on each other. "'Baker wanted to head west, around Cape Magellan, "'but Shulago insisted it was the wrong season, "'that the westerlies would kill us. "'He may have been right. "'Eventually we sailed north, "'to make the passage west between Tasman and Elizabeth's Land. "'My husband was arguing with Baker continuously by then. "'We found Martha's Island by accident. "'Yashova thought we could profitably spend years studying there. "'Well, we got our wish.' "'She stopped again, jaw muscles tensing, "'and looked around the circle of faces, "'alternately smiling and shaking her head. "'Baker was a very disagreeable man,' she said. "'He must have felt Yashova was too much of a disturbing influence. "'He arranged for us to go ashore together. "'The ships sailed while we were ashore. "'I don't know what he told them. "'The journals were lost,' Salop said. "'Chuki mentions nothing. "'Well, Chuki sailed before the Hanno abandoned us. "'We were very afraid at first. "'We knew about the three members of Jittermeier's crew, "'lost here over a decade before. "'We never found them.' "'She rubbed her eyes with the fingers of one hand, "'then blinked in the light of the electric lanterns. "'In a way, Baker did us a favor. "'We've had a good life here. "'Martha provides. "'We never starved, though we were hungry often enough "'and sick a few times from eating the wrong things. "'We came to love her. "'She never bored us.' Sometimes Yashova wondered if our work would ever be discovered. We wondered why no one returned to Martha's Island, but we weren't unhappy.
There haven't been any expeditions since, the captain said. The island isn't on any of the shipping routes, and there isn't much shipping across the Darwin now anyway, unless it's Bryanists.
Nimshian did not recognize the name. Baker and my husband confirmed that the theories of the original surveyors and Jittermeier were correct. The only feasible explanation for Lamarckia's biological nature was inheritance from acquired traits. And yet, inheritance was the wrong word. Jittermeier had speculated about the designers and observers who took the specimens gathered by samplers and thieves and studied them. We have been adding more and more detail to that theory. We've seen an ikos die, Nimshian said. We've seen its preparations for death. The island disrobed. It revealed its skeleton to us, in a way.
And was there a seed mother, a queen? The captain asked, tapping his fingers on his chin.
I'll show you in the morning, Nimshian said craftily.
She smiled and rocked back and forth on her chair, enjoying the hold she had on us.
"'I expect you'll want to explore before you move on.'
"'You're welcome to travel with us,' the captain said. She shook her head firmly.
"'Thank you, but no. I'll return to my island in the morning. Much work remains. I do hope you'll take our results with you and carry them to Athenai or Jakarta.'
"'We would be honored,' the captain said. Nimshian let the dark memories pass and was full of cheer now, basking in human company. Three boats put out the next morning under a low ceiling of thick, knobby gray clouds. Puffs of cool wind and spatters of light rain greeted us as we put ashore where the longboat had landed the day before. With Ser Nimshian taking the lead, walking along the black sand shore with a practiced leggy waddle, our party of 30, the captain, Salop, and the assistant researchers, myself, and eight of the crew who had chosen lots, hiked over the Shulago Trail. The party formed a long line up the slope to the valley. Some of the crew sang songs at first, but the desolation and windy silence and the gray cast of the day soon subdued them. The researchers counted the circles of stones in the old silva and made an estimate of the extent of the silva and the past number of arborids. Nimshian explained that the silva had declined from the shoreline inward. With scions disappearing night by night, their remains absorbed by ecos cleaners. Rock scrubbers had died after arborids, and then all the smaller forms month by month, and year after year. Inland, the larger scions had died first as well, and then the smaller.
The Arborids and Phytids gave nutrition to all, Nimshin said. We believe they died because of the decline of microscopic science.
The decline's cause was unknown. At first, husband and wife had speculated that human-born microbes were infecting the scions, but found no evidence supporting that hypothesis.
We always blame ourselves, Nimshin said, approaching the rise with the last stand of arborids visible beyond. We seem to be guilty about everything, even just being human. But soon we realized humans were trivial.
She could walk and talk easily without losing her breath. We struggled to keep up with her.
Martha tolerated us, even let us take a few of its phytids and arborids and other scions for food and materials. When Martha was alive, every spring season we would hike inland into the mountains to study the blazing red efflorescence, the shedding and bursting of new growth among the phlox trees and divericata, the huge and rare hemohamatids and the coastal halimids. Martha sampled us for 5 years after we first arrived as if we were new. Three-legged scions the size of mice springing out of the lower alsophilids, nipping our arms late in the summer with the penultimate warming of the Jittermeier current. That was unusual in itself. We never discovered why Martha needed to sample us so often and so regularly.
She paused on the rise, bent to adjust her leggings and the socks that had slumped around her ankles.
Then, after 8 years, all by itself, Martha began giving up and fading away. At night we heard what my husband called garbage trucks, the size of elephants, rolling down the naked hills into the ocean. There they exploded like huge balloons, scattering half-dissolved remnants to the waves and currents. The ecos took itself apart hectare by hectare in an orderly fashion. I believe she knew she was dying, and wanted to leave the island clean after she was gone. I realized that is very anthropomorphic of me.
She glanced at us, face saddened by these memories.
We missed her being curious about us. We had taken comfort in those seasonal nips, those little samplings. We even came to believe the ecos watched over us, that she accepted us as independent parts, but that was my husband's idea mostly. 5 years ago, Yashova suffered a stroke, or something like a stroke. Something went badly wrong inside of his head. No doctors, no clues. The ecos didn't save him. He died after 12 days of paralysis. I buried him, but scavengers dug him up and put him with the other scraps and carted him out to sea. Martha has always kept herself clean, very clean.
We entered the grove as large drops of rain fell, drumming on the fine-fringed arborid leaves and dappling our clothes.
"These are decadents,"
Nimshin said, touching the fringe of leafy growths with a gnarled hand.
"They are barren, of course, like old bees dying on a dry rock."
She pushed on, ignoring the rain, and the captain kept up with her, using his stick to prod aside brown creepers that writhed across our path. Salap peered at the leaves through a pocket magnifier, observing their reaction to the rain.
"Sir Nimshin," he called up the line just as we reached the house, "I believe this small silva takes all its water from the spring, am I correct?"
"You are correct," she responded,
her voice rising over the hiss of falling drops. Salap nodded in satisfaction and wiped moisture from his brow. Nimshin climbed to the porch and addressed us in the narrow courtyard. We were soaked by now, but the rain was subsiding, though thick gray curtains still cloaked the slopes of Mount Jittermeier.
"I have something to show you," she said. "You can't all come in at once, but you're all welcome."
We took our turns in groups of six, climbing the steps and shaking hands with her, at which point she introduced us to her true treasures, cabinets filled with hundreds of watercolor sketches done by herself and her husband. Salap was speechless, and stayed inside with Kaiser Bach as each group came through, staring again and again at the paintings as Nimshin revealed them, a new group for each party. She glowed with pride.
"When the silva was healthy," she said, "it covered most of the center of the island in two similar groupings, two silvas, actually, as Jittermeier and Baker and Chulago saw, as we saw when we first arrived. The mountains were more active then.
There were even earthquakes a few times a year, and the beach where you landed was rich with fumaroles venting sulfur.
The watercolors glowed with delicate life, revealing as much about their creators as they did about Martha's Island, sketched in with meticulous care, using very fine pens cut from the central stalks of arborid leaves, colored by dyes taken from vermids and phlox trees high up in the mountains.
"We recorded all we could on the slate left to us by Shulago," she said, "but it soon stopped taking data. We learned how to make a kind of paper, and taught ourselves how to paint. Martha was very generous. She supplied everything, pigments, stems for brush handles, even brush hairs. We ate her scions, and we painted her as a kind of gift. Not that it was any true bargain."
A set of paintings showed the vernal efflorescence in the high mountain valleys, when the arborids and phytids shed old growth and produced bright new leaves of vivid reds and oranges, sky blue and dark purple. The ecos itself seemed to have a painterly plan, the hills covered with zebra stripes of purple against red and sky blue.
"The air smelled like the sweetest, finest wine in the spring,"
Nimjin said, her fingers caressing the paintings, lifting them from their folders and replacing them with religious care. Some of the paintings were of specimens of the largest arborids, named Yggdrasils, hollow cored nets of stiff creepers rising in fat cylinders up to 100 meters high, throwing out tiers of purple-black, sun-absorbing leaves. Yashova had climbed into the hollow trunk of an Yggdrasil and depicted it from the inside, like an intricate weave work narrowing to an open circle of sky.
"We used the few pieces of laboratory equipment over and over again, until all was broken or ruined, and we could only look and see and taste. And sometimes what we tasted made us sick, and we noted the symptoms."
She shook her head ruefully.
"Our own bodies became our laboratories. And then..."
She flipped through sketches of barren lava, slumped and tangled Yggdrasils, until the style became much simpler, cruder. The work she had done by herself after the death of Yashova. The captain's eyes filled with tears, and he dabbed at them with his knuckles, glancing around in some embarrassment. When all of us had seen the sketches, Nimjian stood by the unglazed window, staring at the small grove circling the spring, her voice hoarse and cracking with weariness.
"I need to rest before we do the next part of the tour."
"Of course," said the captain, and he ordered food brought out of our backpacks. We set up a picnic lunch around the house and on the porch, and Ser Nimjian presided like a true matriarch, resting on her chair assembled from fallen Yggdrasil leaf stems. She wore a broad, battered, woven fiber hat to shade her eyes against the infrequent glare of sun peeping between the clouds.
"Captain," she said, "I give all our work to you. I see it all in my head, and it can only be useful taken away from this island. I won't be alive much longer, and the weather would only break in again and ruin everything."
The captain waved his hand as if dismissing her confession of mortality and was about to speak, but she continued,
"4 years ago, we lost 59 sketches when the roof leaked. Months and months of work. Lamarckia is indifferent, and so was Martha, I suspect, but we loved her even so. They were comforting delusions, ghosts of benevolence and care when we were so alone."
We rested in the flowing patches of sun and cloud shadow, alternately warmed and cooled, surrounded by the rustling furred leaves of the grove. Salap and the captain and Randall sat on the porch with Nimjian, who had closed her eyes and slumped in her chair, her breast rising and falling evenly beneath the folds of her robe and jacket. Sherla and Shimchisko lay on either side of me, Sherla on her back, eyes tracking the clouds above, Shimchisko dozing lightly.
"I'd like to sneak off and explore," Sherla said. "I've been bunking on the ship too long, with the mate watching every tickle."
She rolled on her side, facing me.
"Shall we run off to the hills?"
I smiled. "No flarking," I said. Sherla surveyed me critically, one eye half closed, and lay back again.
"It's a bold offer," said Shimchisko, waking from his doze. "What do you see in him?
I can't help myself, she said lightly. It's his mystery. Where did you come from? I know, from Jakarta before you lost yourself in Liz. But you don't talk like a Jakartan, and you don't act like anybody I know. There's a coolness about you.
If mystery gets me out of cleaning the shithouse, I'll be mysterious.
Well said, Sherla commented. Droll defense. Come with me,
she whispered conspiratorially into my ear.
Inland, to the hills.
She lifted her chest and tucked in her chin.
And you'll see my tits.
I nearly choked on my laugh, and she laughed with me. But her eyes had fixed on mine.
The old woman's going to walk us somewhere. I'd love to run away behind everybody and sneak back in later. If you don't want to see my tits, okay, but keep me company.
The heat in me almost overrode my sense of duty, if that was what it was now. Duty had transmuted into a burning curiosity and a rush of other conflicting emotions. Fascination, anxiety, even a kind of patriarchal concern. I'd love to, I said.
Soteria will dock us, she said. You might be cut back to apprentice. Am I worth it?
Sherla had never gone quite this far in her coquettishness. You are, without doubt, the loveliest creature on the ship, I said.
Tell me more, she said.
Much lovelier than Shimchisko here. Shimchisko opened one eye, then closed it again. And you're much too smart to ruin a good sea career. She poked her tongue out between her lips like a forgetful cat and broke our gaze, looking again at the clouds.
One day, she said, I will see your secret nakedness, and I will gloat.
You may see my nakedness any time, I said, by appointment. On Thistledown I had been successful with women, too much so. I had come to think of them as delightful and valuable commodities, worth much effort, but not like me in any serious respect. I could see now, middled in this dreamlike experience, that my attitude carried a taint of youth and foolishness. Sherla was very much like me. Shimchisko was not, nor was the captain or Salap. A steady patch of sun had settled over us. A long gap between clouds making the sun seem to roll down a race course, occasionally fetching up against a wall of cloud and flashing it bright yellow-white. I'm too stupid, I said.
See, Sherla said. Nakedness. Show me more.
I poked her calf with the toe of my boot. Don't provoke me, I grumbled. Nimjian had stood up from her chair.
I'm rested, she announced.
The captain, Salap, and Randall rose beside her like reverent servants.
Come with me, she said,
and descended the porch steps.
You missed your chance, Sherla said, getting to her feet.
Foolish all me, Shimchisko said with a grin.
The billows and runnels of clouds had fled towards the southeast. We marched inland, up the northern rise of Nimjian's valley, the last preserve of Martha's motherless scions. The grove ended at the rim of the valley, and on the slopes of Mount Jittermeier and the hills and mountains beyond, we found the trails and roads of the dismantling. Nimjian pointed out various features as we walked on the path she and Yashova had trained through the Silva over their first 8 years on Martha's Island. Here the site of the Yggdrasil that had stood nearest the valley and their house, now a conical depression 10 meters across, filled with sterile chunks of lava and a bottom of fine silty mud cracking in the sun. There the beginning of the path to the top of Mount Jittermeier, where they had found phytids and vermids suitable for making watercolor dyes. Here again, a kilometer on, a lean-to they had made in case they were caught in a storm far from the house, now fallen to ruin with nothing left to lean against. Higher still, in the cup between Mount Jittermeier and the central Mount Toreg, after an hour of hiking, we stood for a moment in what had once been the thickest silva on the island.
Millions of Yggdrasils and tripod oaks, Nimjian said, shading her eyes at the glare.
In a few hours the floor of this décolletage between the mountains would rise to meet the sun, and all would be in shade. For now it was bright gray desolation, kilometer after kilometer of conical depressions filled with mud. Shimchisko rubbed his knees as we paused and looked up at Sherla and me.
Suicide, he said darkly. The queen chose for her Ikos to die. Out of shame.
Sherla curled her lip. She had little use for Shimchisko's mystical theories.
The captain, Salop, the researchers, and Randall took in the view with puzzled awe. They could no more explain what had happened here than Shimchisko. I looked to the summit of Mount Jittermeier, however, and wondered at the dog that did not bark in the night. No more steam, no more earthquakes, no more sulfur from the fumaroles around the southern beaches. Nimjian sighed and waved us on. She took the lead, her long, scrawny legs pumping steadily, her tireless gait marked by a lean to the left with one step, a lean to the right with another. From 10 or 12 paces behind, I listened to her exchanges with the captain and Salop. Shimchisko complained beneath his breath about the altitude and the effort, about the shame of all this destruction. I shushed him so I could listen to Nimjian, and he regarded me with mild resentment.
"We came to this place 2 years ago, before Martha finally died," she said. "Yashova and I toured around the island then, going where we could never have gone when the silva was so thick. With the phlox arborids and most of the phytids gone, we could go practically anywhere we pleased, and it was here we first came upon structures unlike any we had seen before in any ecos. Yashova named them palaces. I thought it a misleading word. Still, it's his."
Between lava boulders worn smooth by rock grinders and the ceaseless rubbing growth and procession of the silvous tree forms, we looked out across a deep bowl cut from the side of Mount Toreg.
"There are 5 other palaces, all similar to this one. When they died, Yashova believed Martha died as well. These ruins and the orphaned grove are the only monuments."
The bowl stretched 80 meters edge to edge. Within, curving piers and crossbeams the color of old ivory radiated from the center of the bowl like giant rib bones arranged by an ancient hunting party. Dried shreds of membrane still clung to them. In the bottom of the bowl, beneath the tilted and fallen ribs, hexagonal chambers had been carved in the old lava flow. Rainwater pooled in the bottom of the chambers. We gathered abreast in a line along the rim of the bowl. The captain's face was pale. He prodded his jaw forcibly with an index finger, and his lips twitched. Salop stood with arms crossed, lost in concentration, as if remembering a long-ago game of chess.
"The Queen's Chambers," the captain mused.
"What do you think?" he asked Salop.
"Perhaps."
The more intensely interested Salop became, the less he showed any reaction whatever.
"By the good man," Shatro said tentatively, looking to the others to determine the depth of his own reaction.
"Bilge," Nimjian commented. "Hardly a queen's chambers. I never did like the word palace. So misleading. We found 5 of these, all dead all the same. The queen theory allows only one."
"Here," said the captain, pointing to the chambers and vents in the rock along the outer walls of the chambers, "is where the scions are made and released. Given birth, there must be outlets. We should search for them."
"Night's coming in an hour, Captain," Randall reminded him gently.
"Yes, of course. But if we found the outlets, or even if we don't find them, here is where the central controller, the seed mistress or mistresses," he turned to Nimjian, who regarded him skeptically.
"If there are 5, what of it? If there is no central and unique site, no single palace, what of it? I'm not wedded to the notion of a lone and exclusive seed mother. If there were 5 of them, we might think of the others as chambermaids, helpers. One might be larger."
"They're all the same size, give or take a meter," Nimjian said.
"All the same structure."
"But you did not see them alive," the captain fairly shouted. "One might have been festooned, plumed with bright decorations, signifying her status highest of all, the others secondary. There must have been one controller, one head, one authority."
He was still wedded to the queen, after all. Nimjian tapped her walking stick on the ground, irritated in a way reserved for those who have been alone for a long while and are now subject to contrary company.
"Have it your way," she muttered.
The captain ordered Shatro and Thornwheel to begin measuring the palace and gathering samples of whatever remnants of tissue remained. Shatro gave me a lizard-lidded glance of satisfaction as he stepped past. I felt like punching him.
not because the captain had chosen him for this task, but because he put so much store in it and seemed to think I might care.
Water from the bottom of the chambers, the captain mused, oblivious of this brief interchange.
Might be tissues, residues, genetic material there still. We can preserve it now, read it later.
Shatro, Thornwheel, and Cham began to climb down the rough scree to the chambers at the bottom of the bowl. A surveyor's measure was pulled from the equipment box to be sighted on by the captain's slate for later comparisons. Randall glanced at the sun and then over his shoulder at the long, winding walk back to the beach.
Captain, Sir Nimgian probably wants to return to her house, and we should get word back to the ship.
Kaiser Bach stopped, his hands and shoulders quivering with excitement, his face screwed up like a little boy's. I thought for a moment he would pitch a tantrum, but he sat abruptly on a nearby lump of lava and clapped his hands on his knees.
All right, he said softly, then shouting to the men on the path down the slope, Wait! We'll come back tomorrow! We'll bring more equipment! Let's do this right!
Randall nodded. Shirla and the rest of the crew were obviously glad not to be spending a night in this desolation. Shimchisko stared at the palace with dread. He would not tell Shirla or myself what made him so uneasy until we were back on the trail, walking through the empty conical pits in the failing light.
It's ugly, he finally murmured, following a few paces behind me. I thought they would be beautiful. Queens. But it's just like an old collapsed meeting hall. Roof beams and rooms. Nothing more than a hotel.
We don't know what it looked like when it was alive, Shirla said. It might have been lovely.
Hidden. No one can get to them wherever they are, Shimchisko said gloomily. That means they're ugly, dead or alive.
He would not be persuaded otherwise.
And what killed them?
I kept my ideas to myself.
In the Grove of Orphans, the captain inquired whether Sir Nimgian would prefer sleeping on the Vigilant.
Fates and breath, no, thank you, she said. I'm an old woman of deep habit. I came here with Lenk when I was a grown woman, and I married Yashova when I was in my middle years, and now I am old, and I have all my remaining family here.
Tomorrow we'll return and conduct a full survey, the captain said. We'll set up a base camp and examine the other palaces. To be sure, we're beginning a long journey, but you'd be safer if you came with us.
No, Nimgian said. I have no taste for another expedition. We can provide comfortable accommodations. Captain, I've spent the best years of my life here, Nimgian said sharply. Baker and Chulago did us a favor. From what you've told me, we've made our world even more confused and contentious. I'm sure you know the profound peace of devotion to research, to seeing and measuring. I've been present at the end of an ecos, something no other has seen. But the story is not over yet. Why the orphans remain, how they managed to stay alive, why the palaces chose to dismantle themselves and die rather than move. So many questions. Enough to fill the rest of my life.
The captain smiled.
I am envious. But there are larger puzzles to solve.
This is a puzzle on my scale, she said. Do what you must. Take our drawings and results with you, but I am content.
Randall ordered Shatro, Cham, and Kisbeg to stay. The rest of us hiked back to the beach in the last of the twilight and returned to the Vigilant. In the longboat I took a spot on the thwart beside Shirla, who sat with head in hands pensive.
Sad? I asked.
She half frowned, drawing up her cheek and wrinkling one eye shut, then lifted her head and said,
A little lost.
Why?
Queens can die.
Yes.
It's not something I wanted to know, or even wanted to see.
Everything dies eventually, I said.
Back on Thistledown, my father told me, people could choose to live forever. They had machines for inside the head, machines for the body, new bodies, extra brains. I suppose I'd always hoped.
She threw up her hands.
Forget it, I can't even think straight.
You wanted the queens, the Ikoi, to be stronger and better than anything human, and to last forever. She shook her head, though a glint in her eye,
A slight nod before the Nile indicated my guess was close to the mark.
I wanted to visit a queen someday.
I joined this expedition, went to Lenk School and specialized in ecology, and even though I didn't get on as a researcher, I shipped on as a sailor, an apprentice, just to meet a real queen. I suppose I wanted to sit down and talk with her.
One woman to another?
Of course. Mother Nature herself.
She grimaced, daring me to laugh.
It's a lovely myth, I said.
Myth?
She wrinkled her nose.
I wanted her to tell me what was wrong with being alive.
Uneasy myself now, I looked out across the water. The lights on the Vigilant sat on the border between the Black Sea and the starry night. I had never been comfortable around vague dreams and poetic associations. I had abandoned the Naderites in hopes I'd find a philosophy not fogged by uncertain wishes and self-enlarging dreams.
But whatever they are, the queens here are just dead,
Shirla went on.
I still think we killed them. A disease, or maybe just disgust.
What did Nimshian or her husband or anybody else do to disgust Martha? I asked in a jocular tone, hoping to break her mood.
I heard what the old woman told the captain, Shirla said. Baker and Shilago left them here, abandoned them.
Even if they were betrayed, what would that mean to a queen? I asked.
I don't know, she said quietly.
A queen has to fight off other Ikoi and protect a territory and make her scions. She brings them back when they're worn out and she makes new ones. She has to think about things differently. She couldn't have human concerns. I doubt she's a female at all.
I don't care about that, Shirla said stubbornly.
Shimchisko, sitting on the thwart behind us, had listened without comment until now.
She may not be a female, but she's certainly a mother. That's the way I see her.
Shirla stared at the bottom of the boat. In the light of the lantern on the longboat's bow, I saw tears in her eyes, and I was filled with a sudden urge to comfort her. I put my arm around her shoulder, but she shrugged it off. As we climbed up the rope ladder onto the main deck of the Vigilant, I took Shirla aside for a moment and said something that made little sense to either of us, but especially not to me.
When we go into a live, lush Silva, I said, and you ask me to go with you, if you ask me to go with you, I will go.
She seemed about ready to snap back with some angry reply, and her face flushed in the deck's electric light. Then she pulled away from my touch and walked across the deck toward the forecastle. After a few paces, she stopped and came back, with a deliberate swing in her step. She put her hand on my forearm, looked up at me with stern eyes, and said,
"Sir Olmi, I was joking."
She swung around again and walked to the forecastle without looking back. But after helping the captain and Salap store the day's specimens in the cabinets outside the captain's cabin, I went to my bunk in the forecastle, and there I found two paper-wrapped sweets sitting on my pillow, given without clue or comment. It was simply not in my nature to stay aloof and isolate myself. I had to blend in. Shirla would provide a kind of cover. That could be my excuse, at least. In fact, the gift of candy had brought back the hormonal heat. Her sadness, her graceful sway as she returned to give me my comeuppance, put her round face and dark eyes in a new light. By comparison, the women I had known on Thistledown all seemed deliberate and calculating. The comparison was unfair, of course, because my mood was determined by the setting, and the setting was dreamily exotic and more than a little eerie. I, too, had stared at the ribs and remains of the palace and felt something I could not express. I, too, had secretly hoped that perhaps the Ikoi represented something higher and better, but the death of Martha, made even more poignant by the sad grove of orphans, proved to me, as it might not yet have proved to Shirla, that Lamarckia was no heaven spoiled by the presence of humans. Life here followed the same round of nature as on any other world. Things lived, competed, succeeded for a time or failed, and died. We had sullied nothing. Still, some of Shimchisko's mysticism had communicated itself to me. What was eerie, even frightening, as I lay back in my bunk and chewed the first sweet, was the inevitability of conflict, not just between humans, but between the Ikoi and humans. The Ikoi were curious. Perhaps we irritated them. Perhaps they had a plan. I awoke the next morning early with the starboard watch bell ringing. Those not on watch slept through the clamor. I rose and dressed and chewed the second sweet, back to thinking about my mission. Without reason, these thoughts carried me back around to Shirla, and our flirtation on Martha's Island seemed absurd and not productive. Virtually all of my relations with women had taken on aspects of the absurd, especially my abortive attempt at bonding. Nadirite women, particularly divaricates, seemed a different breed from Geshel women. Somehow, when I had been younger, before and even a little after shifting my attitudes toward the Geshels, the characteristics of Nadirite women stacked up in a different way, different results from the same general blend. I had taken up with Geshel women and found them charming, but somehow less attractive, more deliberate, even harder. All women, I thought, were calculating, even if their calculations took place somewhere south of their conscious awareness. All women weighed and measured, did not always listen to the results rationally, but made efforts in that direction that most men I knew could not duplicate or understand. Nadirite women, however, especially those born to the families and not converted, took on a gentler, more innocent approach to this calculation. They did not make you feel inferior when you did not measure up. They simply did not encourage you. Or they let the press of social protections discourage you, all the while convincing you it was not their doing or actual opinion that you were unsuitable. Ulesa had shown me how ignorant I was. In her gentleness, in her shy reticence and quiet style, I had found all I thought I needed. What I learned from her past lovers, for bonding among Voyager Nadirites did not require eschewing all others, was that she presented very different faces to different men. She gave us what she thought we most wanted, and she was usually correct. But knowing who Ulesa really was, that I saw would never be possible. Her attempts to please hid something that disturbed me, a kind of underground disapproval, as if I might be a small boy who needed her, but whom she did not truly respect. I knew of better places to search for uncertainty and mystery, and disapproval hidden or overt. But I still had a weakness for Nadirite women. An old story, I thought, as I prepared the equipment and longboat for the third journey to Martha's Island. I saw Shirla, who would not go ashore this time. She regarded me wistfully. She could not know my thoughts. Fortunately, we would not be together enough, or alone often enough, for my attitude to make much difference. And I had my mission. Memories and sense of duty could quell the hormonal heat. Over the next 3 days, we tramped the slopes of Mount Jittermeier, and I accompanied a team to the summit, where William French surveyed the island, took elevations, and compared them with measures made by Baker and Shulago. Nimjian observed our comings and goings from her porch, accompanied teams on some hikes, and looked over our results. Her critical eye and experience was invaluable. Working from the maps she and Yashova had made, we walked the denuded mountain valleys flanking Mount Toreg and examined the 5 other palaces, all in ruins, even more decrepit than the first. As Nimjian had told us, there was very little difference between the debris-filled bowls. The captain took this information with a disappointed persistence I found irritating. If the evidence contradicted theory, I thought, then the theory should be discarded. Kaiser Bach was unwilling to discard his pet theory yet. He even came up with one of those smokescreen revelations that hide a weak theory in clouds of unverifiability. "The additional palaces may be decoys," he suggested blithely on the quarterdeck of the Vigilant one evening. "Only one may be the real queen's domicile, shell, whatever." Salap seemed constantly irritated as the days passed. He barked his instructions to the junior researchers and received their results with a nod and a scowl. Randall talked with him infrequently and walked away grumbling that the island was not good for us. "Too damned bleak," he said. "I'd just as soon leave." Shirla came ashore with Ebert and Kisbeg, but there was little contact between us. I was inland measuring Palace II, and by the time I returned a day and a half later, she had been sent in a boat to accompany Thornwheel as he surveyed the western wing of the island and its bulbous headland. In late afternoon, with the junior researchers and Randall off to the eastern wing of the island, and the captain on the ship studying the results, Salop came to find me in the Grove of Orphans, where I was resting and eating a spare lunch. "I think we should go dip our feet in the spring and talk," he said. Puzzled about what he was up to, I followed the head researcher through the arborids to the pond, which lay pale and still in the afternoon shadow of Mount Tauric. "Erwin insists there is little for us here, and he may be right," Salop said, removing his shoes and sitting on the edge of the pond. The gravelly basin of the pool was empty, visited only by the roots of the scions. Nowhere on Martha's Island would we find any of the profusion of life that Earth's ecosystem would have quickly provided given such a broad opportunity. No seeds, no microbes, no birds. "I am afraid the palace chambers will be clueless, as sterile as the rest of this island. I do not enjoy being here, even among these orphans," he gestured at the arborids. "She still has her place," he continued, waving his hand around to the house, where Nimjian sat alone, dozing on the porch. "She will happily die here, but..." His voice trailed off. He splashed his feet in the water for a moment. "This place makes me feel my mortality like a knife in my ribs. And you?" I shook my head. "It affects us all differently," I said. The island did not disturb me as much as it did others. Salop had never before confided in me, or to my knowledge anyone else. I was intrigued. The head researcher never did anything, even engage in casual conversation, without having some goal in mind. "If this can die, then other Ikoi can die as well, and perhaps they do. Can you imagine the effect on Calcutta or Jakarta if the zones were to die?" "Disastrous," I said. "French tells me you are the best with the surveying instruments, better even than my researchers." "I enjoy the work," I said. "My privilege to help." "Yes, yes." Salop dismissed that as so much camouflage. "Randall believes you should join the researchers. I have not been satisfied with them in all respects. You have only tagged along so far. Perhaps we should make it formal?" "I wouldn't want to cause friction," I said. Salop gave me a piercing look. "Randall also says you seem to have some goal in mind, and it is not necessarily with the ship or with us. But I would like to speed up our work on this island before we all succumb to the bleakness. It is like conducting a huge autopsy. Will you agree?" Salop looked away from me and stared across the pond, his toe making ripples in the clear water. "I would be honored," I said. "Good. Do not worry about crew resentment. The captain will query you about your background again. He is ever proud of his own education. But I believe in native talent as well, as valuable as native ore. I will convince him." I nodded as humbly as possible. Salop dismissed my act with a wave of his fingers. "Sit here and tell me about this pond. I have my suspicions." "About the pond?" "The spring and the pond. The orphans. Every so often, sitting here, I smell the faintest traces of hydrogen sulfide. The pool is mildly acidic." "I've tried not to advance opinions ahead of time," I said. "Yes," Salop encouraged. "We know so little about what an Ecos needs to survive." "I suspect we think along the same lines, Sir Olmi," Salop said, using the respectful form with me for the first time. He waggled his fingers, encouraging more. "Volcanism has died here. Mount Jittermeier was the last volcano to die. In time, the Ecos would leach out whatever trace elements it needs. Chromium, selenium, cobalt, zinc, manganese," Salop suggested. "All found in scion tissues in stable concentrations, whatever the Ecos, but seldom found in native soils. And for an isolated Ecos like Martha, there's no place else to go." "She withers," Salop said. "But this spring," he dipped his toe again, "the last source of trace elements, a small fissure below ground still warm." "She leaves her orphans here," Salop said. "Perhaps for Nimjian, a last gift between friends?" He sighed, the closest to sentiment I had seen him come. I matched Salop's pensive silence for a while. He looked up, dark eyes steady.
My greatest regret living on Lamarckia is the poverty of intellectual variety. It might take us several more generations to build a base of intellect sufficient to understand Lamarckia, to solve the biggest puzzles. When intellect is found, we cannot afford to ignore it.
He turned away and pulled his feet from the pond.
I will convince the captain.
The captain had for the past 2 days been spending most of his time on the ship, taking advantage of unusual radio conditions and listening with some concern to messages between Shea and Elizabeth's land. He hadn't revealed the content of these messages to anyone but Randall seemed twitchy and drawn as well. It did not take much foresight to recognize signs of growing tension in the small but extended political world of the immigrants. The pools in the palace chambers had turned dark and opaque with debris from the leaking brittle walls. One apprentice, Skop, had fallen into the pool when a wall collapsed, giving Randall the idea of cutting holes in the chamber walls to drain them, creating a kind of canal across the bottom of the palace. I helped set filters to catch solid debris, and Salop took samples of the liquid in all the chambers before the breaching began. The water smelled of mud, coldly musty. I spent half my time the next week ashore and half on the boat, where my new status caused some ribbing among the crew, good-natured and otherwise. Shirla was polite, but little more. Was I above her or still equal to her in rank? Would I shun a mere A.B., even one with scientific pretensions? For my part, I was much too busy to do more than sleep and eat on ship and make preparations for the next trip to the island. Around a cold camp dinner on the island one evening, we named the palaces after ancient royalty: Cleopatra, Hatshepsut, Catherine, Semiramis, and Isabel. On our 12th day on the island, Salop and I presided over the draining of Palace One, Cleopatra. At the same time, Randall, Shatro, Cassier, and Thornwheel began to drain the other palaces. The water from Cleopatra cascaded down the dry, rocky slopes for 20 minutes. A few centimeters of liquid remained in the chamber cells. Rising from the water, surrounded by watery reflections of the sky, lay the remains of the last scions of Martha. Salop climbed along the top of a chamber wall beneath the curve of a dark ivory roof beam, snapping pictures of the decrepit, half-dissolved remains. We then brought up ropes and climbed into the chambers. The melancholy that filled us was universal and difficult to explain. In a sodden mass at the bottom of the chambers lay half-formed larvae of arborids and phytids. Leached of color, mingling with their sylvan cousins, were pterids with thin segmented bodies and leathery wings as delicate as sodden tissue paper, hundreds of them, each no more than 20 centimeters across. Salop lifted one on a piece of close-weave net and said, "These might have been Martha's eyes and ears. I think they are the same as Nimgian's arthropterids." "Samplers," I suggested. "Perhaps. But are they all nascent? Or were they brought back here for disassembly?"
"Nascent," I said.
"Remember, Nimgian saw the dead scions being tossed out to sea."
"Did Martha still have hope enough to make more children, then?" Salop asked.
Ridgel and Kisbeg and Cham, standing in the pools or on the crumbling walls, said little as we passed up fragments of carapace, lengths of rubbery muscle cable, horny claws, brown bones arranged as long slender rods or delicate basket weaves, hanks of fibrous insulation. Clearly some of the larval forms were pelagic. They might have patrolled Martha's offshore waters, guarding against intrusions and maintaining the sterile zone around the island. Equally clear was the strong relationship between these scions and those in other Ikoi. However independent the Ikoi might have been, through convergent design or copying, many scions resembled their counterparts. When Baker and Shulago had visited the island, however, years of isolation had produced many unique scions, some of unknown utility. We found early-stage remains of some of these in Cleopatra's chambers. Legged balls connected by tough cables to form ambulatory chains. Great drums with ridged grips along the rims and tight-fitting lids, perhaps to haul nutrients from one location to another, or to convey volumes of microscopic scions from the palaces. tiny, four-limbed creatures with three equilateral snipping jaws that Salop called muskets. By the end of the day, when we crawled out of the palace and rested on the barren hillside, we had catalogued 70 different kinds of scions, and found fragments of perhaps 20 more, too difficult to quickly reassemble and visualize. Of the 70, 20 had been catalogued by Baker and Chulago, and 45 more by Nimjian and Yashova. 5 no one had ever seen before. "Martha was creative to the very last," Salop said, back propped against a boulder, lifting a jar filled with bony fragments and feather-edged scraps. Early the next morning, Shatro stumbled into camp in the dark, awaking Salop first by nearly falling over him, and then shining his lantern on all of us.
"Isabel," he said, sucking in lungfuls of air. "Number 5! Sir Randall says, come quickly!"
He knew nothing about what was so important, and his hike in the darkness across the rough terrain had taken his breath away. We packed quickly and refilled our canteens. There had been little rain the last few days, and there were not likely to be water-filled reservoirs in the rocks. Shatro led us back along the path in the dawn light. Mount Bedouin stood between us and the sunrise, a black serrated triangle against the brightening sky. One small moon rose over the northern slope of the old volcano, and after a kilometer or so, we turned toward the moon and that slope, where Isabel lay. It was a 10-kilometer hike from Cleopatra, through what had once been impenetrable Silva, and we reached the 5th palace by late morning. Randall and his team had drained the chambers and surveyed most of them by the end of the previous day, leaving only 3 chambers to breach. With a little energy left over, Randall and Cassir had decided to knock a hole in the wall of an inner chamber to get a head start on the next morning's work. "We were about to return to our tents when Cassir shined a lantern into the chamber," Randall explained, taking us down into the bowl. We carefully avoided the crumbling supports for the roof beams, crawled through a succession of holes knocked through the chamber walls, and came to the second-to-last chamber. Randall had no words to describe what they had seen. He entered the chamber reluctantly behind Salop. Above, standing gingerly on the walls, Shimchisko, the only sailor present, waved down at me, but with little energy and no cheer. "I've never heard of Ikoi eating humans," Cassir said, his voice quiet in the shadowed stillness. We splashed carefully between piles of odorless, colorless brown and white bones. From the walls, uncatalogued scions the size of soccer balls, shriveled limbs tightly curled close like dead spiders hung from twisted brown cords. Drops fell from these into the dark, cloudy puddles below. Salop pushed aside the piles to see what Cassir and Randall had spied from above. It lay half submerged, empty eye sockets staring at the sky, toothless lower jaw slumped to one side, giving it a grimly joking expression. Salop hesitated before stooping, and held his hands out for several long seconds before touching the round shape, or the scatter of slumped and broken bones, and a section of feeble gray carapace, like a tarnished cuirass, covering what might have once been a chest or thorax. "It's small," Salop said. "Less than a meter long." "A child," Randall said, his voice shaky. "Never a child," Salop said, shaking his head. "Not a human child." "The skull," Shatro said loudly, lips curled as if offended. "Leg bones and hands," Cassir said. I knelt beside Salop and turned my attention to the hands. They had 5 fingers, but the fingers were unjointed, flexible as rubber. The wrist was likewise 1 unit, and the joint that connected it to a long 2-boned forearm, the bones given 1 twist around each other with a smooth cartilaginous material between, was not the joint of any human. "I've doubted her story from the beginning," Shatro said. "Why would they leave her here? What could she and Yashova have done? Or did she bury her husband? This isn't Yashova or any other human, and there's been no murder here," Salop concluded, standing and coughing. "Whatever it isn't fully grown. It's unfinished." Randall's face became even more pale, his eyes staring at us as if we were dreadful angels. "My God, what then?" "Made here," Salop said. He held up his left hand imperiously, palm up, and coughed again into his other hand. Something in the cloudy water irritated him. Then he looked between Randall and me and said, "Get the largest jars. Throw other specimens out if you have to." He suddenly swore under his breath and glared at the men and women standing on the walls overhead and peering through the hole gouged in the chamber. "Not a word of this to Nimjian, and not a word to anyone on board ship. We will tell them after we've studied the specimen and in our own good time. Master Randall, will you guarantee this for me?" Randall nodded, face still pale. "Good." Digging around the bottom of the chamber, within an hour we found three of the unfinished scions, if indeed that was what they were. I helped Salop photograph the remains, using our hands and a metric ruler for size comparison in case the specimens disintegrated, as some already had. "Send down some hot wax," Salop instructed as the glass jars were lowered. I filled the jars with water from the chamber, and one by one we lifted the fragile remnants and lowered them delicately into the jars, threw the muddy fluid to the bottom. As he sealed the jars with paraffin, Salop looked up at me and said, "A fair imitation, no?" He gave me a grin that seemed more than a little ghoulish. We stored the specimen jars in a small volcanic cave near the beach, out of the sun, and covered them with wet tarps to keep them cool. Leaving us to guard them, Salop and Randall took the longboat to the Vigilant and spent several hours offshore. Shatro and Cassier became involved in an argument about what the human-like remains signified. Shatro was arguing for some sort of conspiracy between Nimjian and the Ikos Queen. He had made some ridiculous elaborations on the captain's obsession. Shatro, I saw, would always limit himself to the opinions of those in authority, and rather than improve upon those opinions, he would make them seem ridiculous. Shimchisko had fallen into a silent funk, head bowed, staring at the sand between his feet as he sat near the cave entrance. I sat beside him, concerned that his cynical cheer had vanished so completely. "Olmi, this is the worst thing that's ever happened," he confided. "Why?" "It's going to tear us apart. Salop can't keep it secret forever. Randall doesn't like it. I don't like it." He shook his hand loosely at Cassier and Shatro, as if dismissing them. "The first time we're in port." I was content just to listen for the moment. In truth, I was stunned myself. "It shakes my faith," Shimchisko said. "First, that this island has died. Now that it was trying to make one of us..." He shrugged. Shimchisko was crafty, but not a quick thinker about large issues. "Why?" He stared directly at me. "I don't know," I said. "They all sample us," Shimchisko continued, frowning deeply. "They steal from each other. Are they going to steal from us now?" The captain came ashore with Salop an hour later. They entered the cave alone, and Salop showed him the jars and described what was in them. When they emerged from the cave, the captain seemed feverish. His face was flushed, and he lurched a little, and took Salop's arm. Looking at Randall and me, he said in a gruff voice, "We need to set sail in 2 days. We'll take a direct course to Jakarta. We don't know what we have. We could stay here and study for years, primary science. But we don't have the luxury. Tell Nimjian we'll be leaving. We'll deliver the supplies we promised tomorrow." "Should we tell her anything?" Shatro asked, deep into his suspicions of conspiracy. Everyone ignored him, and he lowered his head, staring at us sullenly. The captain whispered in Randall's ear. Randall turned to Shimchisko and Shatro, lifted his hand, and swung it to include Cassier and me in the sweep of his orders. "Back to the boat. We need to talk in private." Thornwheel did not seem happy to be left behind. "Let Olmi stay," Salop said. "I'll need him." The captain blinked at him, but did not argue. When Shatro's eyes met mine, he closed them and looked away in pure disgust. He joined the others as they walked toward the captain's boat. "I wish I could talk to the Goodlenk or some of his officers about this," the captain continued. He pounded the black sand with his walking stick, staring out across the blue expanse of sterile sea. The sand made little barking noises with each poke. "What the radio messages say is that Lenk is on a ship to Jakarta right now. Brian himself is going to meet him there. There's going to be a conference. For now, we can't talk to Lenk even if the airways are clear." Randall had apparently heard of this, but Salop had not. "Why should we consult with Lenk?" Salop asked, cautiously puzzled by the captain's line of reasoning. Kaiser Bach's face reddened to a shade of sienna, his cheeks and chin a brighter pink. "We have a responsibility here, and not just as scientists." Realization dawned on Salop, but still eluded me. I had not worked with the captain very long, and did not know his attitudes. Salop was ahead of me, and Randall as well. "You perceive this as a threat?" Salop asked. "What else would it have been if the Ecos had survived? And for that matter, how do we know it hasn't merely gone dormant? Hidden the queen somewhere, insisted to ride out some condition or other." "I do not agree these are possibilities," Salop said. "The Grove is truly orphaned." "The danger is immense," the captain said. "We've learned more on this expedition than any before us in all the decades we've been on Lamarckia. And what we've learned burns." "Perhaps it is innocuous," Salop argued, heat rising. Randall saw the argument coming and tried to intervene, but Salop and the captain both raised their hands, fending him off. "Sir Salop, how can it be innocuous or innocent that an Ecos seeks to mimic us?" "They have always been curious," Salop said. "We are strangers, a new kind of scion, but we do not evoke the responses that guard against thieves or spies. We do not smell as a scion from another Ecos would smell, perhaps. The samplers study our shape, take samples of every individual, carry them someplace, we assume, for analysis. But these samples are much more enigmatic than the tissues of a scion from another Ecos. The language of our genes is different in its very grammar. It takes a long time to puzzle out, even for a master or a mistress." Salop's eyes burned with enthusiasm as if he expressed his own secret dream or nightmare, a religious hope, perhaps. "Somewhere there is a part of the Ecos, a seed mistress or queen or many of them, examining the problem, studying our genetic material, laboring over the puzzles of human DNA, trying to understand the functions it codes for and duplicate them, beginning with the simplest proteins. They have so many problems to solve. There is an immense gulf between a megacytic scion and a many-celled organism." I pictured secret factories hidden in the Silvas, perhaps in organic fortresses much like the palaces, where unknown intelligences worked tirelessly for decades. "We might as well call them queens." "That much is obvious," the captain said. "They feel threatened by us. We steal their scions, we cut them down and make ships of them, or we harvest them and eat them. We have the potential to fill Lamarckia and take all resources. A queen would sense this with whatever instinct she has. She would know." "Sir Salop, didn't you expect to find something like the palaces someday?" "Yes, yes, of course, it was my great hope," Salop said. "I know what we have to do," Kaiser Bach insisted. "We cannot take chances. We must make certain that Martha is dead." Salop seemed ready to spit. He walked back and forth on the beach, glaring at the captain, at us. "You would have us destroy all we have studied? We keep our own samples to show Lenk, but we burn the Grove and try to find the hidden queen." "There is no hidden queen!" Salop shouted. He had lost all of his restraint, and spittle flecked his black mustache. "Martha is dead!" The captain flinched at this outburst. He set his stick down on the sand and squatted, laying his arms across his knees. Salop knelt beside him and put a hand on his shoulder. "It is not necessary to act with such brashness," Salop said, some of his calm returning. "Whatever Martha set out to do, clearly it has come to a stop for now. It appears at least to be dead, or so weakened and reduced that it might as well be dead. We have time to think and to consult. We go to Jakarta. We explain our discovery to Lenk. You can request an audience, even when he is busy with Brian. And you can ask Lenk and his counselors what should be done. They cannot deny us now," he said. "Our own curiosity is not a luxury. We must answer our questions. We must understand these processes."